Habakkuk, again, if we're going to learn about him, all we can do is look at the book. And so the study of him is the study of his book. But notice he says in verse number 2, O Lord, how long shall I cry and thou wilt not hear? He's praying to God for God to do something and God's not doing anything. Can you relate to that? Can we relate to the prophet? O Lord, how long? How long shall I cry and thou wilt not hear? You notice that's why it says in verse number 1, the burden which Habakkuk, the prophet, did see. The other prophets were given messages. They were given visions. But it just says the prophecy or the vision. With Habakkuk, it says the burden, and there's a special emphasis in that word. As he looked at the nation of Israel and saw their iniquity and saw their sin and saw the righteousness of God, and he said, Lord, how long can these two things coexist? How long can your purity and our immorality continue to run side by side like that? Lord, how long till you do something? And it was a burden to him. Look back, if you would, at Nahum, the book right before it. Look at Nahum chapter 1 and verse 1. The burden of Nineveh. There's only three of these minor prophets that start with these words, burden. All right, Nahum was the first one, the burden of Nineveh. And we studied that last week and the transgressions of Nineveh and how they turned their back on God. And Nahum was burdened over the city. Look at Malachi, the last book in the Old Testament. And we'll be with Malachi in just a few weeks here. But look at Malachi chapter 1 and verse 1. The burden of the word of the Lord to Israel by Malachi. And if you know Malachi and what he's going to say, I have loved you with the Lord, yet you say, wherein hast thou loved us? And Malachi is a bunch of questions, God questioning Israel and Israel questioning God back. And it's called the burden of Malachi, the burden of the word of the Lord. So these messages that these prophets were assigned to pronounce were not just up intellectually and academically pronouncing the word of God. And it's very easy for preachers to do that. It's very easy for us to get up with our heads full of information and simply preach the facts and the information. But when the facts are translated to a burden, how much more is accomplished? And you and I need the burden of the Word of the Lord. We need the burden of God. Not just saying, well, we believe the world is lost. We believe it's going to hell. We believe in supporting missionaries. We need a burden for those things. Because when there's a burden, it drives us more than just an intellectual assent or an intellectual knowledge. And so we see the burden of Habakkuk, and his burden was caused by the silence of God. How long, O Lord, shall I cry, and thou wilt not hear, and cry unto thee of violence, and thou wilt not save? As he looked around the nation of Israel, and he saw the calamities, he saw the violences, he saw the iniquity, he was burdened and said, God, how long? Notice number one, he was burdened by God's inactivity. He was burdened by God's inactivity. And again, he says in verse number 2, how long, O Lord? Why aren't you doing something? When are you going to do something? What are you going to do? Habakkuk just knew that judgment was deserved. And he couldn't understand why God wasn't sending it. Can you and I say today that we could walk around our nation and look at our nation? I mean, folks, we live in a corrupt and vile society. And everywhere around us, we're as Christians, everything we see, everything we do, everything we hear in the world that's around us defiles us. Those in the workplace, the conversation, the things that we're exposed to, the things that are in this world. Again, I mentioned Sunday, just turning the radio on, and I turned the radio on again today driving, and I was listening to the Christian radio station. I was up north today, and I was in the area where I could pick up the station out of Coshocton. And then I got too far north to where I lost it. Once you get about New Philly, you lose it. So you turn to something else. And for me, it's usually a sports channel if I can't find a Christian music set. And I listen to that, and that was fine till the news came on. And the news came on, and the first thing they'd say every time, I don't know why it is, the first thing is about some sexual crime that's been committed against some man, against children, some rape, something like that. And I just say, I don't want to hear that. This world is just consumed with filth. And they don't even think twice about it. And we look at this and we say, God, how long? God, how long can your justice and your mercy be extended to our nation and to our world? And so he was burdened by God's inactivity. Notice it said in verse number 1, the burden which Habakkuk the prophet did see. As he looked at the nation of Israel, everything that he saw, he said, we're ripe for judgment. We're primed for judgment. And I believe we can look around our nation and say the same thing today. Look at our world and have the same thing and say, Lord, how long? He was burdened by God's inactivity. Number 2, he was burdened by gross iniquity. He was burdened by gross iniquity. Beginning in verse 3, he says to the Lord, as he looks out over the nation of Israel, he says to the Lord, why dost thou show me iniquity and cause me to behold grievance? They call that sorrow. Lord, why are you showing me? Why are you revealing to me the sin? You know what you and I need, folks? We need God to reveal to us the iniquity that's around us. Because we are so human. We are so fleshly. I mean, even in our spiritual state, that a lot of what is around us is iniquity and we don't even recognize it. You know, we get hardened to it. We get used to it. The conversation, the filth, what's on television, what's on radio, what's all around us, magazines, newspapers. We just kind of flip right by it and don't even realize that God's grieved by it. It's sorrow. And so God showed Habakkuk. God opened his eyes to see everything as he stood. Notice in verse chapter 2 and verse number 1, he says, I will stand upon my watch and set me on the tower and will watch to see. Habakkuk has been put on a mountainside. He's been put on a tower. He's been put on a stand to sit down and watch and look at the nation of Israel. And he looks as if God opens his eyes. And when he opens his eyes, he says, yuck. It's filthy. It's vile. It's ungodly. It's wicked. And you and I, if we could have the vision of God, we would see the world the same way. We would sometimes see our own lives the same way, and we would clean things up. But we don't recognize iniquity. He said, why dost thou show me iniquity and cause me to behold grievance? Notice, for spoiling. I said verse number 3, and this isn't on our outline, but verse 3, why dost thou show me iniquity and cause me to behold grievance? That's sorrow. Then he says, there's spoiling. For spoiling and violence are before me. Prosperity spoils. Having everything spoils. Dawson, are you going to get spoiled? Your older brother's getting ready to go, and you're going to be the only child left behind. The only child in the house. Buddy, you got some tough times coming. It'll be wonderful in one extent. All that stuff that you used to share will all be yours. But you know what? With that prosperity, with that blessing, I look in our daughter Erin's room, and I see more toys than all 6 of my other kids had put together. Because, you know, when they're all 6 growing up at the same time, well, you can't buy all 6 of them something, but now they're gone out of the house and there's just one. She cleans stuff out. She separates her games. What's going to go in the yard sale this year from what's left behind? And it's still 10 times more than what she needs. And that's not a complaint. That's not a bad thing. But spoiling can be a problem. The nation of Israel, prosperity spoiled them. Folks, we live in a spoiled nation. I mean, we complain about the economy, and justly we do so, but there's nobody out there suffering. There's nobody out there going without meals. You go into any of the restaurants to eat, and they're backed up, and there's people packed up, and those are the same people complaining that they don't have enough for this and don't have enough for that. But they can get something to eat if they need to, and I'm not saying there's folks out there that aren't going through hard times, but we live in prosperity, and that prosperity causes iniquity. Because when people have a lot and have everything, they tend to spend it in the wrong places and for the wrong purposes. And so Habakkuk looked out and he saw the sorrow, he saw the spoiling. And then notice the next thing, and violence are before me. There are that raise up strife. Sorrow, spoiling, strife. These are almost a ladder of iniquity. All right, it comes from the sorrow, then it goes to the spoiling, then it comes to strife. You know what prosperity does? Spoiling, it causes strife. Nothing else to do. Let's sit around and talk about each other. Let's sit around and pick things apart and criticize things and then offend people and then start strife and everything. You know, we got nothing else to do, so let's pick a fight. I don't mean necessarily go put up your dukes, but let's complain about things. Let's find things to do. You know, when people are busy and hard at work, they don't have time to do that. But we live in a society where there's lots of free time, lots of downtime. And so there's a lot of things, there are lots of time to do that. And so he saw that strife, idleness produced strife. And there, as he looked at the nation, as he's sitting on his perch and looks down, he sees the sorrow, the spoiling, the strife in verse 4. Therefore the law is slacked. He saw slackness. The law is slacked. And judgment doth never go forth. That corruption reaches the courts. They can't keep up with it. They've got to open the prisons and let people out to let more violent offenders get in. Violence is slacked. I read something on the internet. It was on Facebook, and somebody posted it about a man that has been in prison for so many years, and they're wanting him to get out. They're saying he served his time, he's done his thing, but they never listed what his crime was. It was a petition. You were supposed to sign the petition to help let this guy out of prison so he could see his grandkids, but it didn't tell you what he did. And I thought, well, you know, I don't know what he did. Why would somebody sign a petition to get somebody out and you don't know what crime put him in there in the first place? Justice is slacked. Note, look back if you would, keep your place there, but look back at the book of Ecclesiastes. This is a verse that America needs to consider and the nations need. Ecclesiastes chapter 8. Ecclesiastes chapter 8 and verse 11. Solomon, the wisest man that ever lived, made this observation. Ecclesiastes chapter 8 and verse 11. Because sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. You know what he's saying? That punishment deters crime. That's how we would say it in our 21st generation. Punishment deters crime. You know, there's out there folks saying, well, I'm against capital punishment. I don't believe in that. Well, God permitted it in Genesis chapter 9 and verse number 6. God said, if any man sheds blood if any man sheds blood, his blood shall be shed. It shall be given for. There's a lot of cases in the Old Testament where God said, if somebody premeditated, now he gave a city of refuge for accidental. But if somebody premeditatedly slew someone else, God said his life is to be taken. Paul said in the New Testament, he said, if I've done anything worthy of death, I refuse not to die. He put his okay on the law of Moses that capital punishment was justified. And yet in that sense and everything else, we live in nations where we just want to overlook sin. We want to, well, it wasn't that bad. It wasn't that guilty a thing. It should be, Ecclesiastes, Solomon said, it should be punished speedily. And so we see that as he looked down at the city, he saw the iniquity, and he was burdened by gross iniquity. The silence of God. God, how long? Look at what I'm looking at. Look at what I see, and how long will your judgment hold off? Then notice, if you would, let her be. And here's an astounding thing. The statement of God. The statement of God. God simply tells Habakkuk, I see it, and I'm getting ready to do something about it. Remember, Jonah preached. Nineveh repented. 150 years later, the judgment came because they turned away from God. Israel now has turned away from God. Judgment's coming. Nahum had predicted it 100 years before. Now Habakkuk says, it's coming. The judgment of God is coming. And as Habakkuk announces it, God says, all right, Habakkuk, just hold your horses. It's coming. Here it is, the statement of God. God says, I'll take care of it. I see Israel. I see what they're doing, and I'm getting ready to do something about it. I wonder when God looks down at America if he's not saying, I'm getting ready. 20 years from Habakkuk's vision, from his message until the destruction of Israel. Notice, number one, the conquering by a wicked nation. The conquering by a wicked nation. God says in verse number 5, he says to Habakkuk, all right, Habakkuk, you're looking at Israel, you're beholding their iniquity, you're up on that tower, you're looking down. Now look across the nations of the Gentiles. Look across the other places. I'm going to punish my people. Look at the nations of the Gentiles. What do you see? And God says in verse 5, behold ye among the heathen and regard and wonder marvelously. Habakkuk, wonder marvelously. Why? For I will work a work in your days which you will not believe, though it be told you. Habakkuk, I'm getting ready to do something. I'm going to punish Israel, and the way I'm going to punish them, you're not going to believe. Behold wondrously. You're not going to believe it, even if I told you. Notice verse 6. For lo, I raise up the Chaldeans. Habakkuk, as you look out over, if I'm going to punish the nation of Israel, look out over the other Gentile nations, who do you think I'm going to send to punish Israel? Oh, well, Lord, maybe these folks, they're not quite so bad, or these folks. No, God says, I'm going to go pick the wickedest and most ungodly of all nations and let them invade my people Israel. Folks, that would be like God saying, all right, I'm going to punish America, but I'm not going to send the Canadians in. I'm not going to send South Americans in. I'm going to go get the Iranians and let them take over America. You and I would say, well, wait a minute, God. I mean, if you're going to pick somebody, wouldn't you at least pick a Christian nation? Or somebody with a Christian God? I mean, would you go out and pick a Muslim nation like Iran? I mean, you could maybe you think of a different one, but I would think that would be the most wicked nation I could think of to overrun America. And by the way, they're the ones that sponsored the terrorism that comes around here. And yet, Habakkuk looks out and he sees, and God says it's the Chaldeans. Verse 6, I raise up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation, which shall march through the breadth of the land to possess the dwelling places that are not theirs. They are terrible and dreadful. Their judgment and their dignity shall proceed of themselves. Their horses are swifter than leopards and more fierce than the evening wolves. You read down through there, and God describes what he's going to bring the Chaldeans. Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonians, the Chaldeans, that's all the same group. He's going to bring them in to invade Israel. And Malachi or Habakkuk standing back and saying, oh, Lord, how long do you judge Israel? And then he says, wait a minute, you're going to use them? You're going to use that nation of all people? You're going to use the Chaldeans, the conquering by a wicked nation? Then look at number 2, the corruption of that wicked nation. The corruption of that wicked nation. He doesn't bring in a nation more godly than Israel. There isn't one. He doesn't even bring in a mediocre nation. He brings in the vilest, the most terrible, the most wicked. Notice verse number 13 of chapter 1. Habakkuk says to God, Lord, thou art of purer eyes than to behold evil and canst not look on iniquity. Wherefore lookest thou upon them that deal treacherously? Talking about the Chaldeans. Lord, I know you can't stand iniquity. That's where you're going to judge Israel. So how in the world can you bless the Chaldeans and bring them in and give them victory? And holdest thy tongue when the wicked devoureth the man that is more righteous than he. Lord, Israel's bad, but they're better than the Chaldeans. Lord, Israel deserves your punishment, but of all people, the Babylonians? And he beholds, and he wonders marvelously, as God had said back in verse number 5. And he does not believe it. God's going to bring in judgment from a wicked and ungodly. He's going to let that nation defeat Israel. Are we surprised when some men come to the United States from some of those nations that hate us, take training from our own people and fly airplanes into Twin Towers? God just simply says, I want you to know, if judgment's going to come, it's going to come from the wickedest and vilest of all people. And so we see the corruption of that wicked nation, the silence of God, the statement of God. Then in chapter 2 and 3 of the book of Habakkuk, we see the sovereignty of God. The sovereignty of God. God is all-knowing. He's all-wise. He's all-powerful. He can do whatever he wants to, and nobody's going to stop him. People can question him. They can doubt him. They can assail him. But they can't stop him. So he says, well, I don't believe in God. Help yourself. Good luck. He's still going to exist. Whether you believe in him or not isn't going to make a difference. Well, I don't think there's a rapture. I don't think there's a judgment of God. I don't think there's a great white throne of judgment. I don't think there's a judgment seat of Christ. Help yourself. It's a free country. Think anything you want to think. But God's still going to do what God's going to do because he's God and we're not. He's sovereign. He's all-ruling. In chapter 2 and chapter 3, we see that. We see the Lord's answer to Habakkuk to why he's going to bring in who he's going to bring in. Notice number 1 in chapter 2, the prophecy of Habakkuk. The prophecy of Habakkuk. In chapter 2 and verse 1, I will stand upon my watch. All right, the remark is that Habakkuk is the tiniest person in the Bible because he can stand upon his watch. All right, no. Anyways, I will stand upon my watch and set me upon the tower and will watch to see what he will say unto me, what I shall answer when I am reproved. All right, he's at odds with God. God, why? When are you going to do something about the nation of Israel? Then when God says, here's what I'm going to do, he says, what in the world are you doing? Why are you going to use them? So he's questioning God, and God gives him an answer in chapter 2, and that answer is a prophecy, verse number 2. And the Lord answered me and said, write the vision and make it plain upon tables that he may run that readeth it. For the vision is yet for an appointed time, but at the end it shall speak and not lie. Though it tarry, wait for me, because it will surely come, it will not tarry. And what God gives Habakkuk in chapter 2 is a prophecy that was going to be fulfilled in 20 years and in 2,000 years. Because the prophecy of the Chaldeans and Nebuchadnezzar coming to overrun Israel is a prophecy of the Antichrist during the tribulation coming to overrun Israel. It's a vision of something yet in the future. A lot of folks, when they read Habakkuk and when we study the book of Habakkuk, they miss it and think, well, everything was fulfilled 20 years later. No, it's a prophecy. It's a vision that was going ahead 2,000 years. Notice small letter A. God was going to destroy them because of their greed. Now he's talking about that nation, the Chaldeans. He's not talking about Israel. That's over. He's going to allow the Chaldeans to come in and overrun his people. Then he's going to destroy the Chaldeans. First of all, because of their greed in verse 4 down through verse number 8 of chapter 2. Look at verse 5. Yea, also because he transgresseth. This is talking about Nebuchadnezzar and the nation of Babylon. Because he transgresseth by wine, he is a proud man, neither keepeth at home, who enlargeth his desire as hell and is as death and cannot be satisfied. His appetite for conquest. He cannot keep it home. You know what Nebuchadnezzar did? He wanted to just conquer every nation, like Alexander the Great. Conquer every nation that was out there. His appetite was never satisfied. He would defeat one nation and want to go war against another. Defeat that one, go war against another. His greed caused him to defeat all the different nations. He still wanted more. Look at verse number 8. Because thou hast spoiled many nations, all of the remnant of the people shall spoil thee. He became an enemy of everyone, and so eventually everyone's going to become the enemy of him. God would destroy that wicked nation. Yes, he's going to allow them to overrun Israel, but then he'll turn the tables on them and destroy them because of their greed, small letter B. God would destroy them because of their goal. Because of their goal, verse number 9. Woe to him that coveteth an evil covetousness to his house, that he may set his nest on high. See, that's the goal of that wicked king, Nebuchadnezzar, that would come in. He wanted to be exalted. He wanted to be lifted up. He is the remnant, by the way, of Nimrod back in Genesis chapter 10 and 11 that we looked at recently. Nimrod that built the Tower of Babel and wanted to ascend to God. Here's his descendant, Nebuchadnezzar. And he wants to conquer the world, and he wants to set his nest up on high, that he may be delivered from the power of evil. He wants to be the conqueror of everyone. That was his goal. So God would destroy them because of their goal. Letter C, God would destroy them because of their guilt. He gives another woe in verse number 12. Woe to him that buildeth a town with blood and establisheth a city by iniquity. The atrocities of the Chaldeans, the Babylonians, when they went in to conquer a place was just unimaginable. Again, we think of the modern day crime. We think of Stalin. We think of Mussolini. We think of Hitler. We think of these leaders that were known for these great atrocities, and Nebuchadnezzar exceeded them all. They would go in, and we talked about the Ninevites, and that was the capital of Assyria. And again, all of these, they would go in and just slay people and pile the skulls by the side. Women and children were never safe. Just like Herod that slew all the children under 2 years old in the days of the birth of Christ, so Nebuchadnezzar and the Chaldeans were that wicked, that godly. They were a bloody place. And God said, "Woe to him that buildeth a town with blood and establishes the city by iniquity." God would destroy them because of their guilt. Small letter D. God would destroy them because of their guile. Their guile, G-U-I-L-E. Verse number 15. Woe to him. There's another woe. Notice the woes. These woes are being pronounced on the wicked, ungodly place that's going to overrun the godly place. And he says, "Woe to him that giveth his neighbor drink." That'd be a good verse for every bartender. Be a good verse for every driver of every Budweiser truck. You know, their excuse is, well, you know, it's just like guns. You can sell a gun, but it's not up to you what the guy that buys the gun does. So the beer drinker says, it's not my responsibility what it does. But God puts a difference between those two. God says, "Woe to him that giveth his neighbor drink, that putteth the bottle to him, that maketh him drunken also." You know, God's system is simply this. When that fellow drives down the road with the six-pack or the bottle in his lap, and he hits that other car and kills those other people, God says not only is the driver responsibility, but God finds that back to the person that gave him the drink in the first place. That's why I taught my children, when you get a job, you don't work anywhere that peddles alcohol. Because I don't want you handling it, touching it, delivering it, giving it to somebody, because God will hold you responsible. You don't know what you give it to them. You don't know what they're going to do when they go out the door. You don't know what's going to happen out there. It's just like giving them drugs, giving them something that changes their behavior. God said, "Woe to him that giveth his neighbor drink, that putteth the bottle to him, and that makest him drunken also, that thou mayest look on their nakedness." Notice that drunkenness and nakedness in the Bible are always associated. Every time you find drunkenness in the Bible, you will find nakedness. You go back to Moses coming down from the mountain with the Ten Commandments and the nakedness and the parting that's going on. All these, all through the Bible, they're associated through there. All right, God would destroy them because of their guile. Notice it says in verse 16, "Thou art filled with shame for glory. Drink thou also." Go ahead. Have your fun. You know, folks say, well, there's nothing wrong with a little bit of social drinking. You know, no drunk ever started without a little bit. No drunk ever just started out the first day drunk. He started with a little bit. And social drinking is just a doorstep to a little bit. I mean, it's like a little bit of poison. Oh, it's all right to have a little bit of poison. It won't hurt you. He said, "Woe unto him." So they destroy them because of their guile. Then small letter D. God would destroy them because of their gods. God would destroy them because of their gods. Verse 18. "What profiteth the graven image that the maker thereof hath graven it?" Babylon, the Chaldeans were known for their idolatry, known for their worship of false gods and other gods. You read the story, when you understand this thing, and then you go back to the book of Daniel, which happens after the book of Habakkuk. Again, though Daniel is placed in the canon before it, when you get the timeline right, you find out that all that happened in Daniel happened when Nebuchadnezzar came in. And you realize how terrible Nebuchadnezzar is. Then God strikes him and makes him as the beast of the field and sends him out there for seven seasons, and he's like that. Then when he comes to himself at the end of it, he extols the God of heaven. You realize what a change has taken place in that fellow. Because the Bible tells us about him and about that nation and their gods. He says in verse 19, another woe. "Woe unto him that saith to the wood, awake, to the dumb stone." Notice that word dumb. He said at the end of verse number 18, "Who trusteth therein to make dumb idols." Now in our slang, we use the word dumb a little bit differently. It just means eyes have they, but they see not. Ears have they, but they hear not. Mouths have they, but they speak not. That's what the psalmist said a couple times in the book of Psalms. They're just dumb idols. And people bow down to them. People worship them. The Chaldeans were well known for their idolatry and for their wickedness that was involved in their idolatry, their heathen practices. So God says to Habakkuk, "Don't worry about Babylon. I'll take care of them." And he gives them that prophecy. Then in chapter 3, verse 1, a prayer. of Habakkuk. We see number two, the prayer. The prayer of Habakkuk. And that's what chapter 3 is about. The prayer of Habakkuk, the prophet. Notice what he prays for in verse number 2. O Lord, I have heard thy speech and was afraid. He's heard everything in chapter 1 and chapter 2, and he's fearful. He sees the iniquity of Israel. Now he realized that God's remedy for that is to raise up a nation more ungodly and wicked than Israel even is. And he says, O Lord, revive thy work in the midst of the years. Small letter A, his desire for revival. In verse 1 and 2, Habakkuk's desire for revival. And again, look at what we've read. God puts him on a tower. He shows him the iniquity of Israel. He's burdened for their iniquity. God shows him the answer, what he's going to do about it. Bring in Nebuchadnezzar and that wicked nation. And that just challenges him and says, Lord, that's not the answer. Bring revival. Revive thy people. Revive thy work in the midst of the years. What should we do when we actually recognize the wickedness and the iniquity that's around us? Do we pray for revenge? No, we pray for revival. God, revive thy work in the midst of the years. He's high. He's lifted up. God shows him what he's going to do. And he has a desire for revival. Revive thy work in the midst of the years. In the midst of thy years, make known. In wrath, remember mercy. Then in verse number 3, God gives Habakkuk a revelation that matches the book of Revelation at the end of the New Testament. Notice letter B. Letter A was his desire for revival. Letter B is his divine revelation. In verse number 3, God came from Teman, and the Holy One from Mount Paran, Selah. His glory covereth the heavens, and his earth was full of his praise. This is what Habakkuk sees. After getting that prophecy in chapter 2, and after getting his heart right, he no longer wants revenge. He no longer wants retribution on Israel. Now he wants revival. And God blesses that desire in his prayer with a revelation of number 1, the vision of God. A revelation of the vision of God. In verse 3 down to verse 6. In verse 4, we've read verse 3 and verse 4. And his brightness was as the light, and his horns coming out of his hand, and there was at the hiding of his power. Before him went the pestilence, and burning coals went forth at his feet. He stood and measured the earth. He beheld and drove asunder the nations. The everlasting mountains were scattered. The perpetual hills did bow. His ways are everlasting. Notice this revelation that he gets, this vision. He sees the Lord high and lifted up. I'm reminded of Isaiah chapter 6. In the year that King Uzziah died, Isaiah 6 and verse 1, I saw the Lord high and lifted up, and his train did fill the temple. Habakkuk gets one of those visions of God. It's a revelation of future time. Again, it's not about something that's going to happen 20 years later, but something that's going to happen over 2,000 years later, when the Lord descends from heaven with a shout when he comes back. He's given a vision of God. Then number 2, in that divine revelation, he sees the victory of God. The victory of God. In verse number 7. Verse number 7. I saw the tents of Cushan in affliction, and the curtains of the land of Midian did tremble. Was the Lord displeased against the rivers? Was thine anger against the rivers? Was thy wrath against the sea that thou didst ride upon thine horses and thy chariots of salvation? Thy bow was made quite naked according to the oaths of the tribes. Even thy word, Selah, thou didst cleave the earth with rivers. The mountains saw thee, they trembled. The overflowing of the river passed by. The deep under its voice and lifted up his hands on high. The sun and moon stood still in their habitation. At the light of thine arrows they went, and at the shining of thy glittering spear. Thou didst march through the land in indignation. Thou didst thresh the heathen in anger. A vision of the judgment of God. Revelation chapter 6. The wrath, the bowls being poured out, God's anger being poured out on the nation. Habakkuk got a vision of God's judgment, of God's justice. His victory, small letter A, his victory defeating his enemies. His victory defeating his enemies. The Chaldeans will be nothing to God. He can brush them aside easily. Nebuchadnezzar's nothing. He's going to get him down and eat grass. make him have the face of the man, but the skin of an ox and the feathers of a fowl. God could touch a man and turn him into something just like that. And one of these days, God's going to show his victory by defeating his enemies, and small letter B, by delivering his people. By delivering his people. Verse number 13. Thou wentest forth for the salvation of thy people, even the salvation of thine anointed. Thou woundest the head out of the house of the wicked by discovering the foundation. And he begins to talk about how God will punish the wicked and restore his own people. Again, it's a future prophecy, not just of what happened 20 years later, but of what's going to happen yet in the future now. We know the end of the story. God destroys his enemies and delivers his people. Judgment will come. We learn a lot by the life of Habakkuk. We learn a lot by his burden. May God give us the same burden. May he open our eyes to see this society, this nation the way it is, so that we don't get entrapped by it. You know why we get seduced by worldliness and ungodliness? Is because our eyes are not open to see the iniquity. We get sucked into it because our eyes are not open to see the iniquity that's out there. And so we need to say to the Lord, Lord, open thou mine eyes, that I may see and behold wondrous things. Let's stand together tonight with our heads bowed and our eyes closed. Our God, thank you for the story of Habakkuk, his burden. God, we can't imagine to be, we can't begin to imagine.